not necessarily to the exclusion of other areas such as religion, but certainly gaining increasing emphasis as the society seeks to adjust its culture to what it's doing in the political and the economic arena. One could even apply modernization to aspects of family life. Family modernization would involve, among other things, reduction of the birth rate. Now, modernization theory is widely assumed in certain kinds of scholarship. For example, Russian historians, and I really think this is a wrong application of the theory, Russian historians routinely refer to the Peter the Great's reforms as modernizing. Latin American historians frequently refer to modernization. It's a hard concept to escape, but it has its bitter critics, and even aside from criticism, it has severe limitations. The criticisms are twofold primarily. First of all, critics argue that looking for a single direction in world history in the modern period is simply oversimplifying very complicated patterns. Even within single societies, they will argue, like the West itself, while you can talk about modernization for some groups, what about workers? What about agricultural laborers? What about even women at some points? Not every group proceeds in the same direction at the same pace. And certainly this criticism can apply to an effort to see modernization on a world stage. Modernization, obviously, and this is the second objection, risks holding societies that seem to be slow in the process up for some particular kinds of criticism. A staple, for example, in modernization literature in the 1950s was, why is Turkey so slow to modernize? It's been trying for 3-4 decades. Why isn't it there yet? Well, that's not necessarily either a fair or a useful vantage point on Turkish history. Attention, then. There is arguably something to the modernization notion, and I'll come back to that in a moment, but we also have to play that benefit against the undoubted reality that modernization unfairly tries to simplify directions that different groups and different societies will take. It's also important to recognize, even if you like modernization theory, as I still sort of do, even if you like modernization theory, there's a lot of areas of social life to which it does not apply. For example, France and the United States probably would be regarded as equally modern if you measure government, industry, standard of living, etc. But the United States is a much more religious society than France. Modernization does not predict exactly what will happen to religion. Modernization doesn't predict crime rates. There used to be the notion that with modernization, certain kinds of crimes would increase. But if we actually look at crime rates over the past 2 centuries as societies, quote, modernized, sometimes they went up, sometimes they went down. There is no pattern. There's a modernization of police forces fighting crime. There's a modernization in criminals' technology, more likely to use guns, blah, 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 but no modernization of crime itself. So the theory has to be limited in this respect also. Even, and we'll touch on this in a later discussion, even conditions of women, although they may, quote, modernize in some respects, modern women are likely to become more educated, in modernizing societies, women may be pulled out of the labor force or they may be added in. There's no pattern. So the theory, even if you like it, is limited. And finally, and this is a tricky one that I want to mention now and we'll come back to it, modernization has to be distinguished from mere westernization. That is, societies may modernize without becoming Western. 2 examples. 1, societies may modernize without becoming democratic. For example, if we use modernization theory, the Soviet Union clearly modernized in the 1920s, 30s, and 40s, but it did not become, by Western standards, democratic. Can't use the theory for form of government. Another really important example that will help control our use of modernization theory, even if we like it. Japan clearly modernized, if we can use the theory at all, beginning in the later 19th century, but it did not become Western. It copied aspects of the West. It became more like the West, but it did not westernize across the board. Distinguishing between modernization and westernization may help us save the concept, though it obviously adds some subtlety. All right. We will look at aspects of modernization in various aspects of world history from this point onward without trying to overuse the theory or shortcut actual exploration. For the long 19th century itself, and particularly for its final decades, late 19th, very early 20th century, it seems to me there are three areas in which one can see common trends in virtually every major society in the world. Very different levels, but common trends. One that we probably don't pay enough attention to is quite simply public health. Headed by Western sanitary ideas and engineering, increasing numbers of societies, whether under Western control or not, realized that governments needed to take more responsibility for public health measures, cleaning up swamps, controlling sanitation issues in the cities, etc., because the result would be healthier and more rapidly growing populations, sources of economic and military strength. What we might view as modern public health measures were born in Western Europe in the 1830s and 40s, maybe with some antecedents before. They spread quickly to the United States, though more rapidly in the North than in the South. Japan, as it began to encounter Western influences from the 1860s onward, adopted new public health measures as one of its first interests, seeing again the clear utility of new efforts to limit disease, control contagion, etc. Even colonial situations by 1900 began to see the introduction of new efforts at public health, if only because the colonizers realized that they needed to protect their settlements, white settlements, against contagion, and they couldn't look to those settlements alone. They also had to pay attention to other, quote, native sectors of the city. Public health concerns spread rapidly in Latin America in the later 19th century, again, in emulation of Western patterns as middle-class reformers tried to discipline lower-class habits, which they found as uncivilized and dangerous, in the interests of greater social hygiene. In other words, although at very different levels, virtually every part of the world, or at least the urban sectors of every part of the world, was attempting some new levels of public health by the end of the 19th century, and as a result, the stage was set for the massive global population increase that would occur in the 20th century that has more to do with public health measures than any other single factor. Second limited modernization sector, education. By 1900, virtually every society in the world was attempting to expand student exposure to schools and to spread schooling to at least some limited sectors of the lower classes, at least in the cities, and to add technical and scientific subjects, at least to some extent, to the educational agenda. Now, this might be a massive effort, as in the West or Japan, where by the 1890s, virtually every child of appropriate age was in school. That was modernization of education writ large. But colonial authorities, much more gradually, but still recognizably in India or even Africa, colonial authorities began to create some new access to education, sometimes assisted by missionary efforts. China would expand its attention to student life by the 1890s, among other things, beginning to send students to learn from other societies such as Japan, the United States, or Western Europe. The impulse to spread education, it still might be very limited, or it might be literally universal. The impulse to spread education and to redefine it somewhat was quite widespread. Third area of limited 19th century modernization involved military technology and organization. A society first encountering the West, or at least encountering the West in a new and more ominous relationship, would almost certainly look to improving military technology and copying Western forms of military training and the organization of officers above all. This is one of the first things Japan did. China would show interest here earlier than it showed interest in economic modernization. And again, even the colonies changed the training of troops in order to provide effective fighting forces. Thus, the British, in essence, modernized aspects of the Indian military in India, providing new kinds of weapons and new kinds of training. Segments of the African military, under the French, for example, would be modernized in similar directions. This is one reason why in so many cases in the 20th century, leadership of new states will come from people who had received military training. They had more exposure to what we might vaguely call the modern world than did some other members of society. All right. The point hopefully is clear. Without yet arguing that modernization was coming to describe global history in the long 19th century, that would be too sweeping. We are arguing that despite the huge divisions that we referred to earlier, there were some common patterns of change that had interesting implications for the future. And then in the 20th century, we may see greater utility in some version of the modernization concept, so long as we remember its limitations and the criticisms to which it's legitimately been subject. One phenomenon that also spread widely in the 19th century that has, I think, an ambivalent relationship to modernization, one phenomenon was the rise of nationalism and nationalist loyalties. Nationalism, simply put, is the belief that there is an identifiable national culture that is measurably different from other cultures, has different historical traditions, has different artistic and literary standards, has a somewhat distinctive value system. Often, probably usually, cultural nationalists will go on to argue not only is our culture different from others, it's also, frankly, better. And most nationalism will also go on to argue not only is our culture distinctive and better, it should also be connected to our state, either an existing state or a state we should have. So nationalists typically argue that there are recognizable divisions among peoples based on different national traditions. Sometimes some racial or ethnic thinking will be added in as well, but these aren't essential. And that these traditions should be housed in an appropriate state that will express the national interest and the national identity. Nationalism, although we can see hints of it earlier in world history, in certain kinds of political loyalties, and perhaps particularly in cases like China, where there were such efforts to shape a national culture, at least at the elite level, and attach it to the state. Nationalism, in a full sense, is a modern phenomenon. It contrasts with more traditional types of loyalty, either to religion or to locality or to both. If you scratched most people in 1750, any place in the world, and ask, who are you, where are you from, you would normally get an answer, I am of this religious faith, and or I am of this village and small region, and that constituted the horizons. Nationalism was born, I think, of two factors, and it was born in Europe. It was born first of an objection to Enlightenment thinking that tended to argue that all peoples were fundamentally the same. A current of thought reflecting, among other things, the fact that nation-states were already beginning to exist in Europe, a current of thought headed, interestingly, by some German thinkers in the 18th century like Herder, a current of thought argued against this to focus on the particular identity of individual peoples. That was factor number one. The second factor was the extent to which increased population movement associated with early industrialization and urbanization and the creation of a new kind of middle class gave an audience first for a type of loyalty that would be larger than the locality and would help uprooted peoples in the city see a sense of identity even though they were cut off from their local roots. And nationalism also provided middle-class people a way to argue about political loyalty and identification that would be different from aristocratic loyalty. Aristocratic loyalties went to class and often crossed regions, as aristocrats more easily identified with other aristocrats than with their own society. Middle-class thinking increasingly saw nationalism as an alternative to this, and also possibly an assistance to the development of more national, wider markets that would also help them economically. Nationalism was then born in Western and Central Europe. It received a huge boost from the French Revolution, not surprisingly the first case in which a national anthem was generated. The French Revolution, by tearing down local institutions and reducing the power of the church, basically created a situation in which many people argued that now that the government belonged to the people and the people of France owed it the kind of loyalty that became associated with nationalist fervor. From Western and Central Europe, and from the enthusiasm of the French Revolution itself, nationalism obviously quickly spread in two additional directions, visible by the late 18th, early 19th centuries. First of all, it spread to the Americas. United States nationalism probably did not clearly exist before the American Revolution, though there were certainly hints of it. But it most certainly followed from the Revolution as Americans began to argue, we have our own society now, we need to define it in terms of characteristics and loyalties in ways that will differentiate us from the old world. Nationalism clearly spread to elites in Latin America and was fundamental to the nationalist independence movements that we'll talk about in our next discussion. Nationalism also began to spread to Eastern Europe. Serbian nationalism, for example, can be identified as early as the first decade of the 19th century. Greek nationalism clearly surfaced soon thereafter and was in the 1820s applied to a new attack on Ottoman control that would lead at the end of the 1820s to the independence of the Greek state. In the case of nationalism in the Americas, nationalism was obviously primarily used to form new states or to undergird new states and identities. In the case of the spread of nationalism to Eastern Europe, nationalism obviously became a force that attacked some of the great traditional multinational empires. And from the early 19th to the early 20th century, much of Eastern Europe and the Middle East became a battleground between new particularistic nationalisms and the larger political units of political entities such as the Austro-Hungarian Empire or the Ottoman Empire. Nationalism spread to the Middle East by the middle of the 19th century, at least as some Arabs began to write about an Arab nationalism that would be a new kind of political expression. Different, obviously, from European control or influence, but also different from traditional measures in Islam. Nationalism would spread to India by the 1880s with the formation of the Indian National Congress. It spread clearly by the 1880s to Japan. By the 1860s, I should have noted this earlier, nationalism is clearly visible in the writings of Russian intellectuals, and hints of this occurred earlier. Nationalism by the 1890s is also visible in the emergence of a Young Turk movement. And by 1900, African leaders are beginning to talk increasingly in nationalistic terms. In other words, during the long 19th century, from the 1750s to 1914, nationalism was effectively created and gained some attention in virtually every part of the world. Now, the attention levels varied. As with modernization, we're not talking about absolutely uniform trends. Nationalism in Africa or in Turkey in 1900 was undoubtedly largely an upper-class phenomenon, some military leaders, that sort of thing, important because it operated at the leadership level. But nationalism was not yet a mass loyalty. This would be something that would occur in the 20th century. India also saw mass nationalism only after 1900. But the fact that this force spread so widely is obviously intriguing. What's involved? Several points, it seems to me, are worth emphasis. In the first place, obviously, as in Europe originally, nationalism provided some loyalties for people facing rapid economic and political change, sometimes moving toward cities, nationalism, as it contrasted with more traditional loyalties, clearly had new meaning. Nationalism also provided some interesting alternatives to traditional loyalties in some other respects. Most important here, although the boundary lines have to be watched carefully in each individual case, most important was a certain implicit tension between nationalism and the more traditional force of religion. Nationalists might argue that their religion was an important part of the national tradition. Many Indian nationalists, Hindu nationalists, would argue precisely this. But the question, if push comes to shove, is the national loyalty or the religious loyalty primary, was an interesting one that began to be posed in the 19th century and would continue to affect people on into our own day. If, for example, you're a Middle Eastern nationalist confronted with an aspect of Islam that may seem to hold your society back, what do you do about it? Islam is certainly an important part of the national tradition, but maybe it needs to be modified. Maybe some other interests need to come first. The tension between nationalism and religion, although not always breaking out into overt conflict, is something to keep an eye on in a number of political stories from the later 19th century onward. Nationalism, and this is indeed in some ways part of the same argument, nationalism usually helped people simultaneously entertain the possibility of a certain degree of change while insisting that change had to be modified or controlled by attachment to tradition. All nationalists, you can't be a nationalist, I think, without arguing that there are some national traditions that are absolutely sacrosanct that give your society its special flavor. Now, these traditions may be real, or as many historians have noted, and it's a very useful concept, these traditions may be invented. For example, from the 1880s through the 1920s, many Japanese leaders argued that reverence for the emperor, reverence for Shintoism was a vital part of the Japanese national tradition. Well, frankly, that wasn't entirely true. It sounded good, it could be believed, but it was partly an invented tradition. And nationalists almost everywhere have been busy for the past 200 years inventing new kinds of rituals that soon become converted as if they were long-standing national traditions. An interesting example close to home, the tradition of Thanksgiving, was an invented tradition introduced by Abraham Lincoln in the 1860s as a means of fostering national unity. It seemed like it referred back to colonial experience and a long pattern of American holidays, but it didn't. It was an invented tradition, though a very useful and hopefully pleasant one, to which shopping parades and football were soon added, actually in the 19th century itself. All right, so nationalism has to argue that there are important traditions. They may be real, they may be imaginary, but they're there. But nationalists are also likely to argue that in order to express national strength, certain kinds of changes were needed. So under the guise of nationalism, you might argue that we need more attention to industrial development. We need changes in our styles of dress so that we can become more efficient and businesslike. The Turkish leader Atatürk in the 1920s will, for example, argue that Turks should abandon their traditional headgear in favor of Western-style hats because hats were more modern and respectable and therefore would actually defend the interests of Turkish nationalism. Interest in change could be quite sweeping. Most Indian nationalists would come to argue that the caste system itself had to be cast aside, no pun intended, because it hampered national unity and national resistance against the British. Look to nationalism then, and this is one of the things that can relate it in odd ways to modernization. Look to nationalism to provide an interesting mixture of traditional attachments and identities, a sense that we are different from everybody else, with some sense as well that we need to do some things differently, perhaps like other people, perhaps like the West. Nationalism, finally, was obviously an increasingly important rallying point for many peoples around the world against the West. It worked better than invocation of purely traditional loyalties did, because it united people across traditional boundaries of class, caste, or even gender. It spoke a language that Westerners themselves used, and therefore could be utilized to make Westerners feel guilty in ways that invocation of traditional religion might not. Nationalism spread as a global force beginning in the long 19th century because it served so many different purposes, and particularly, of course, because it served as the most convenient rallying cry in a world increasingly controlled, at least for a short period of time, by the West, but a world in which different interests had defined expression.
Lecture 27, Formation of Latin American Civilization.
Our discussion today focuses on developments in Latin America in the long 19th century. We've sketched some very general patterns of world history in the long 19th century, the new force of the world economy as the West industrialized, the limited but possibly measurable development of modernization, certainly the force of Western military strength and imperialism, the spread of national loyalties. But each of these larger factors needs to be seen in context of particular civilizations' experiences. We don't have time to deal with each individual case, and we've tried to make some reference to particular cases as we went along. But we will indulge one major case today, that of Latin America, where hopefully we can see, without belaboring the point, the action of some of the larger forces, but in a particular context where particular historical experiences worked out. Latin America is an important instance as well, because there is a general concern in world history about making sure that appropriate attention be paid to Latin America beyond generalizations about the emergence of a peripheral economy and that sort of thing. Latin America, like some other parts of the world, including North America, does not loom in world history as the source of one of the great traditions. It's a borrower of forces and influences from other places that then merge with more local elements and traditions. But Latin America has had a varied and significant role in world history, and this discussion today is meant to capture some elements of it. From the colonial period, Latin America, which in many ways is the world's newest major civilization, although we'll need to talk about at least one other candidate, from the colonial experience, Latin America had developed a number of important features. Its economy was in many respects dependent on that of Western Europe through the intermediary of Spain and Portugal, though particularly by the 18th century, important local manufacturing and other economic activities had developed. We don't want to overdo the dominance of exports. Latin America also, and one Latin American has argued that this is actually the most distinctive issue that Latin America brought in from the colonial period, Latin America also had developed some significant issues concerning the formation of effective governments. Given the importance of outside intervention, of colonial control from Spain and Portugal, as well as economic interference from some other sectors, given the importance also of landlord rule in many parts of Latin America, developing central governments that have had any kind of effective control over the larger territories they officially ruled was a significant issue. Spain and Portugal had both tried to address this issue during the 18th century in a series of reforms called the Bourbon reforms after the dynasty back home that